I'm Nadia Cheney. I am so excited to welcome you to the Adaptogen podcast, where we learn the journeys, the obstacles, the obsessions, and the professional tips from facilitators all over the world.
Conflict tells us where our relationships need to deepen. Right? So conflict actually shows where we are not aligned, where there has been a distance in our connection. And so when it emerges, it's telling us you need to come together. You need to come closer to each other. I mean, first and foremost is that conflict is a part of humanity. Like this is just, it's like the way we need to breathe to survive, we also need conflict.
Whoa,
to grow.
Wow.
Oh, totally. My name is Moyo. I live on Treaty 13 territory, Tikarondo, Torondo to most people. I live here as a settler from Zimbabwe. And I'm trying as best as I can to live on this land in ways that respects the indigenous peoples of this land and to contribute to the land and the people in a good way. I am a community worker, and I also work with Bloom as a consultant and director.
I'm so curious. Can we just start right with your story? What brought you to facilitation? How did you get into this work?
So I was born in Zimbabwe, and my mother was an organizer during the liberation struggle for independence. And so was my father. And so I grew up with stories of liberation, decolonization, you know, anti-colonial movements, and the way that my mother and father and other community members were doing the work on the ground to end colonialism in Zimbabwe. And so in those conversations, of course, you know, a liberation struggle is not a struggle that is fought by one person. It is a community struggle. But to bring people together, you need to bring them together. Right? You need to facilitate. And so there were like a lot of stories of how, you know, my mom will run with information to different families during the day and then bring people together at night. The preparations that needed to go in place so that people can be there in a safe way. Because at that point, if you were caught going to a meeting to plan the struggle, you were dead.
Oh, wow.
Right? The colonial government had people within communities, of course, and at the height of the liberation struggle, at the height of the war, there were Rhodesian soldiers everywhere. So even within the community itself, you didn't really know who you were to trust and who you were not to trust. So there was a lot of thought that was put in place to ensure that you're talking to the right people, that the right people came to the meetings. And then when people came to the gatherings, so these gatherings happened at night, and people would have food, they would dance, they would sing, they would do theater, and they would like have, you know, lecture style conversations. I learned about Marxism when I was like 6 years old, for example. Wow. I learned about the Algerian struggle, Palestinian struggle, all those struggles when I was very, very young. And this is because this was shared at these meetings to plan how to undo colonialism in Zimbabwe. So that's where I come from. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where you come from. Wow. So you're 6, 7 years old, and your mother is this incredible organizer. Are you imagining yourself already in these roles, or what was it like for you to be in this? What was emotional?
It was very inspiring, and of course frightening.
Yeah.
One, how did you survive when so many people died, and you were at the center of organizing communities, like in our area? Was one of the areas where the actual fighting happened. there was a lot of fighting there, and a lot of people were displaced because it's a mountainous area, so there are places to hide, right? So guerrilla fighters loved to come and stage fighting there because they knew that they had the protection of the natural environment, but also that meant putting community members at risk. I remember my dad told me this story of how one time we called them brothers and sisters. So wanamkoma nana, wanamkoma nana, nana, nana hundreds, brothers and sisters who actually carried the guns and stuff. So they came and my dad was an informer. So they said, well, we heard that there are Rhodesian fighters down by the dam. And we want you to go and count how many there are so that we can figure out how to attack. I mean, this is brutal stuff. This is brutal stories, but this is real. This is what happens in certain liberation encounters, right? So he said he was very afraid. He was very scared. And he didn't know how to do it, because if he just goes and starts counting people, you know what will happen? He'll basically be killed. They would know that he's doing something.
Yeah.
So what he did was he went to find young boys who were herding cows, and he said, you know what, today I'm gonna take your cows to the dam so that they can drink water. So he took a group of cows and then passed next to where the camp of the Rhodesian army was, and that's how he counted. And then he got the cows to drink, and he brought them back, and he gave the information that was needed. So it was like frightening. How did people survive this when they were exposed in this way, when they were so vulnerable, when they were asked to do risky work?
Right? And these incredible solutions.
Incredible, very creative solutions.
And then
I started like really loving, like desiring to make a difference, to take risks for liberation wherever I would go. At one point, actually, like, I mean, because one of the things with these liberation struggle stories, you learn to be very nationalist, right? You learn to like associate liberation with fighting and war and stuff like that. That I even thought of going into the army. I even applied to go into the Air Force when I finished my high school.
Wow.
I didn't go. I'm so happy. That is not the...
You had developed a strong sense of these are my people and those are those people.
Exactly. So a very strong sense of, you know, there is injustice in the world and there is a particular group of people that are benefiting from this injustice, a particular group of people that are being disadvantaged because of this injustice. And I belonged to that group of people that was being disadvantaged because of the injustice. So I had that. And one thing that I also learned from this was learning how important it was to read and understand, and especially history. I loved history, to just understand, and that sort of broadened my understanding of like how just generally oppression works. In different contexts. I told you about like the Palestinian struggle, the, you know, Vietnamese struggle, Korea, you know, Iraq, and all those places. I learned about that when I was in Zimbabwe at an early age. Yeah.
So you didn't go to, didn't join the Air Force.
No.
So how did your vision change? What changed for you?
To be honest, I think change. So the idea of justice and advocating for justice began there. Right? How to achieve it really shifted when I came to Turtle Island, which is Canada, US. When I came to do my undergrad at Trent University, which I did in economics, if you can believe that.
You know, we're like 10 minutes in and I'm already like full of surprises. Okay, so you're studying economics.
I'm studying economics,
presumably.
So I did actually like classical economics, the capitalist one.
Wow.
And then, but in my third year and fourth year, I started doing economics of developing countries. Mm-hmm. But even as I was doing my economics, I started organizing in Peterborough around racial justice, bringing communities together to really have conversations around equity, around, at that point, the Trent University had this program where students would go to Ghana or Ecuador to do international development studies. And it's a very colonial venture, right?
Yes, yes.
So we started having communities, conversations in the community around how do we actually decolonize the way we think about the development. And we would organize what we called decolonization dinners. We would have these conversations.
And similar to the conversations you were having at night in Zimbabwe.
Exactly, exactly. Wow. But here, like the strategy was dialogue, right? Dialogue. Yeah. Let's
have this conversation.
The stakes are different. The idea of coloniality and colonization remains the similar, right? It is not about now, colonizing land, right? It is resource extraction. Mm-hmm. It is covering up indigenous knowledge systems. Mm-hmm. It is about, creating sort of, what would I call them? Creating these opportunities that took away from local people, mm-hmm. right? So the opportunities would benefit people from outside of countries, for example.
Yeah.
It is perpetuating this idea that people from the outside are the ones that have knowledge and this knowledge they can share, and if they share it, then people develop, all that deficit approaches to working with communities.
Yeah.
So we're having these conversations.
And you're facilitating them, or
I am facilitating them. Organizing.
And you're very young at this point. You're just in your 20s.
I'm exactly early 20s. And that was exciting because I was sort of facilitating in the university community. I started an organization called African Council at Trent. But I wasn't satisfied with just being in the university community. I wanted the whole Peterborough community to have these conversations. Because the way I understood change was, change is a collective endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
It should not be centered in one institution or one particular community.
So does that mean you'd already started breaking down this, these are my people and these are not my people?
At that point, I had already sort of come to understand that we all have a stake,
mm-hmm.
right? We all have a role to play. Now, my understanding of that wasn't too involved. I wasn't too evolved in a way, because I was still, I was still focused on, liberation for African people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I still do. I'm still, forefront liberation for African people. However, I have a much broader and a deeper and nuanced understanding of oppression and how people are affected by it differently, and how everybody, is affected in a different way, and how we have to come together.
I imagine that, I imagine that the facilitation, as this nuanced understanding grows, your techniques must have had to change.
Oh, absolutely.
So you must have a lot of technique you can still trace right back to your mother.
Absolutely.
But then there must be this whole other.
Absolutely. Well,
I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah. So here's actually the evolution that happened around methodology, right, or techniques. So the story of my mother, they did community work using song, using food, using theater, using humor, and all those things. When I came to Trent, it was very much lecture style, like that I sort of adopted, because that's what I saw other activists in the community doing. So we'd organize a space, people will gather, and then there's a speaker, right? And so that kind of like was my, you know, my way of doing things for a while. So I did like the speaking circuit for a bit. yeah, so there wasn't like much participation from the people that were there. Like it was like a one-person show, right?
Where you can learn, I mean, there's a certain amount of technique you learn from that as well. Hold the audience.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a whole art in itself.
Yeah.
Right. And at the same time, it is very much limited.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't believe, and you know, we can debate this, but I don't believe that we learn well when we're being spoken at. I don't believe that you are, it becomes about you. It's like it's centering mm-hmm. you as the person standing in front of people, mm-hmm. right? You're not in a circle, mm-hmm. you know, you're not really sharing. Like you are part of the dialogue as this avant-garde, right? Like as this like revolutionary, right? In the traditional sense, as like the leader, you know, of the dialogue and you know, so it does not feel adequate.
Mm. So how do people learn? How do people learn best?
My belief is actually, I believe that people learn through relationships.
Yeah.
Through building connection with each other. And so if you think about the story of my mom, so like song, mm-hmm. you know, dance, you know, food, you know, call and response, like there is dialogue that is happening there. And there is fun involved, right? And there is like different ways that people are connecting to knowledge and understanding, you know, the body, you know, sound and, you know, art and words,
story,
like it's all
of
story, memory. Yeah. It's all there.
Yeah. Right?
So I kind of like deviated from that for a little while until I started. Until I became friends with Rihanna, put it that way.
Whoa, I was not expecting you to say that. Okay, yeah. Tell me how that happened.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And in that friendship, we're both interested in gathering people and learning. Like one thing that we really connected on was this around idea of learning. Both personally, like I love learning. I'm like looking for ways to do things and connect with people and all that stuff, right? And she was also on that journey. So we started a series of gatherings that we called TLC, the Learning Community. Hmm. And would have them in the basement of in my house, which was a basement at High Park and Bloor. and what we'll do is we'll invite different people to lead a conversation. Right, or an activity. And that's when I learned like nonviolent communication. I learned like different facilitation techniques, especially like arts-based techniques, you know.
And was this very experimental? Was everybody kind of making it up and together? Yeah, or were you bringing experts?
Well, it was more like not experts, but people who were curious about something.
Wow.
Yeah.
The learning community. Yeah.
Exactly. We are like, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it was the learning community. The people that would lead were not necessarily experts in whatever they were leading. They were just like really curious about that specific issue or topic. And then they would invest the time to learn about it and to figure out how to facilitate so that we can all have like a collective learning experience.
And did you have principles around that? At that time, like, were you like, okay, so how can this be participatory? How can this be active? Or was it whatever they brought?
No. It was like very much open. Like think of like open space learning, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. We just trusted that the person that will show up will, you know, share in ways that affirmed everybody's ability to participate or desire to participate and belong.
Oh, I wish I'd been there.
Yeah. So that's where
How long did you do that for?
We did that So that was, we started that in 2009.
Okay.
And went on 2010. So we started in 2010. And then Rehana left for India 2011. So we stopped for a little bit. And then when she came back, we started having conversations about starting this consultancy and Bloom. And then when we birthed Bloom, we started again the TLCs, but now we're doing them at OISE.
Okay.
Yeah.
OISE is?
University of Toronto, Ontario okay. Institute of Studies in Education. Okay. And that's where Rehana and I met. We met in a class.
Okay. Okay. So now you're coming back to it. A consultancy is very different than a kind of investigation-based circle. So how did you all make that leap? Like, how did you make the leap to saying, okay, well, we have something that we want to offer. How did you know what it was you wanted to offer?
We were not very clear, to be honest. We kind of figured it out along the way. Mm-hmm. What we were clear about was we did not want to talk at people. Mm-hmm. We did not believe that intelligence is the only intelligence that, you know, is legitimate or valid. Mm-hmm.
Very radical at the School of Education, I suppose.
Yeah, we were very much excited about tapping into the body, using the arts, using stories. I'm a storyteller, I'm a musician. So using the arts, using music,
Rehana's a dancer.
Rehana is a dancer. So we were very clear that we wanted to experiment with all these other modalities, knowing that they have been used elsewhere, right? Other mm-hmm. people were using it. We're very much influenced by Freire and mm-hmm. Augusto Boal, among other, you know, other facilitators. At that point, I had been, you know, learning about art of hosting. Rehana mm-hmm. had been learning about art of hosting. So we're really excited about using all these techniques from art of hosting, the circle, the, you know, World Cafe, all those modalities.
And did you know who you wanted to intervene with? I mean, were you still thinking anti-oppression and
yes.
colonization in a global
yes,
context?
Yes. That was at the center. That was definitely at the center. What was clear, at least to me, was I didn't want to do anti-oppression workshops.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right. I wanted to do systems change.
Okay. Tell us a little bit what the difference is.
Well, the anti-oppression workshops tend to, like, you know, you go to an organization and they say, we want you to do two workshops and yes. on, you know, unconscious bias. And you come and talk at people and you, you know, tell people what's wrong with them and all that stuff, right? Well, uh-huh. that is what tends to happen.
It is.
Unfortunately. And whereas systems thinking is, the beginning point is to say we exist within a system, right? Like starting from we are a system as individuals who exist within systems that are layered, right? And that what we do at an individual level affects every other system that we are connected to. And what happens in the systems that we are connected to affect us as well, mm-hmm. right? But with systems change, the understanding is that we know that change takes time to take place. It's not going to happen through a single workshop or two workshops or even a series of workshops, right? We also know that you have to think about all the levels of the system in whatever intervention you use, right?
Brilliant.
So you can't, if you just
very
like-
Very interesting.
Yeah, if you just like do one workshop at focusing on how people think, you're only working with the mindsets mm-hmm. for a very short, but we know that you know, people think, people feel, right? People are embedded in structures, right? So an intervention has to account for all this. And it also has to take time, mm-hmm. right?
This is a very bold ask for a consultant to come into an org yes. or a company and say, this is, it's what you're asking for is not sufficient. We need to do this other thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you needed proof. You needed something to pitch with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, fortunately, a lot of organizations that we talk to kind of get it right away. Mm. Right. If you ask a person to reflect on how they have changed themselves, they did not change overnight.
Yeah. Right? And then
not by the mind. Mm. It involved a lot of things at the center of it, with systems thinking, at least from my view, from an Ubuntu view, is that it is about relationships. You mm-hmm. change systems through cultivating relationships.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and thinking about everything as connected in this web of relationships. Like everything is connected. That is, you know, that might sound obvious, but it is not to many people. Everything is connected.
It's not, especially if you're being told what to do or you have extreme pressures in your life, that those connections can easily be buried, actually. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how did you account? So what I hear in this is I hear a very open, heart-based, body-based kind of work. How did you keep the focus on the imbalances of power?
Oh.
You know what I mean? Like, it could seem like, oh, okay, this is fun. But how are we doing? Is there I guess my question is, how did you
account for power
within this? Yeah.
Yeah. Also, the focus of the work was not, what can I say? It wasn't about what is not working, right? It wasn't about the oppression.
Okay.
Right? Oppression was a part of it. What I draw on and what I love is really thinking about it from an appreciative standpoint. Right? What is working within the system, right? And that asks you to really think differently about power, right? In the sense that power is always thought as this thing, as a commodity that one possesses so
it
that
can
they
gain,
can
try
exactly,
to gain.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like it's an object that can then be used to oppress others, right?
Yes. Yes.
I say yes, and power is also the assets that we have, the knowledge that we have, the assets, right? The knowledge that we have, the feelings of empathy and compassion that we
already
have.
Given, things we already
exactly
have.
We already have.
Wow.
Right? So how do we draw from that power to move towards more compassion, more empathy, more sharing, more deeper relationships with each other?
So you're not even looking for an enemy at this point at all.
No, no.
There's at fault.
No. I think the finger pointing has its limitations. I think it is important for people to be aware of how the structures and the systems that we exist in benefit some and take away from others, right? Mm-hmm. Like that is very important to, but I don't think that is the only angle that we need to approach power from.
That's not necessarily a path to change.
Exactly, exactly. Like we can analyze what's not working well, and there's so much to draw on from that. Yes. I am curious about how do we work together to imagine a whole different world, a whole different way of relating to each other. How do we use the positive power that we have, the collective power that we have, like power with, right? Power together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of power, that's how actually I like to approach power.
I love that. That so then I'm almost thinking there's power in everything. The breath has power.
Of course.
The gaze has power. The posture.
Of course.
Yeah. And then do you think of that as like a limitless kind of function of relationship or?
Yeah.
It's very beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also in that, we're also going to talk about the other power that is creating separation. Mm-hmm. Right.
So yeah, you're not going to pretend that's not happening.
No, of course not. Of course not. Yeah. I mean, I have a PhD in social justice for a reason.
Yeah, and a BA in economics.
Because that's what drove me to do that, right? Like economics, economics was actually accidental. I started in a business program and I disliked it so much. but I especially disliked writing essays, just to be honest. I did not like writing essays, like words did not interest me in that way. But I loved maths, right? Mm. I loved math. So I ended up going to economics because it was more theoretical. It was more mathematical. It was easier for me to do.
But you must have learned in that economics some of these aspects of power.
Of course.
Especially with your background in history and your own personal background.
Yes. So when I knew that the economics that I was learning was not the economics that sustains everybody. You know, the supply and demand stuff is all speculation. Yeah. Economics, it's not a science. It's you know, whatever science, but it's not the way it is presented as like this science, you know, where because we use mathematical models, then everything is accurate.
You have guarantees and patterns.
No. It's nothing. Exactly. It's speculation. It's also about affirming structures of economic relationships that benefit some and take away from others. So, where was I going here?
Well, now we're at the beginning of Bloom.
Right.
And you have these ideas, you and Rehana have these ideas and these practices that you've developed together. And you have very different backgrounds. And we're going to interview Rehana as well. So that's going to be an interesting intersection to hear how her story kind of comes to this point as well.
Right.
So I'm curious about these early days at Bloom. And I'm really curious about your experience as a facilitator. Like, what were you facing? What were the obstacles you started to encounter as you this dream or this vision of this consultancy sort of opened up when the dream meets the ground, kind of?
Right. Well, there were many challenges. I mean, there was, of course, pedagogical challenges, methodological challenges. There were also business challenges. Right. So we kind of have moved from, you know, hanging out in my basement apartment to thinking about how can in an, you know, capitalist reality, how can this sustain us without it being, how do I put it? Without us necessarily playing the capitalist game.
Fascinating. Okay. Right.
Without us. It's an interesting dance. It's a very interesting dance.
So, I think there's a lot of people listening to this who have this struggle, have this question.
Yeah. It's a very, like, what is our ethics here? Mm-hmm. How do we understand equity? How do we apply that in the way that we do this business? Right. So there's that, those challenges. So let me begin with the, let me go to the methodological challenges. So I told you, I am used to be, most like my, most of my training has been in activism, right? On the front lines with organizations working around, you know, mostly around anti-racism stuff. In Peterborough at ACT, we really focused on anti-Black racism. In Toronto, we focused on, you know, Black liberation, and a lot of the folks that end up going to start Black Lives Matter Toronto, I organized with them at the Network for Pan-African Solidarity.
Then in 2010.
That was in 2000 and so I was already doing my PhD. So 2012, yeah, 2012 onwards. And the main approach was really talking the expert, right? Mm-hmm. You come the expert speaker, so to speak, not expert facilitator. And so there was a challenge there. Like we wanted to do all, to do these things differently. We wanted to facilitate differently. But I personally did not feel confident that like I had it down, you know. How do I use a song to facilitate? How do I like tap into the body? What do you do? Exactly. Like the theory was there for me.
The but what there, brings like, the people along?
Exactly. And... what brings the people, you know, like what do you do when people gather?
Yes.
Right.
And especially if it's not in the culture, like it might've been, maybe I imagine in Zimbabwe, yeah. Your mother was picking up on all pre-existing
of
cultural
course, of course,
practices.
Of course, of course, of course. But yeah, it wasn't.
But you go into somebody's organization, it's not necessarily given that they sing together.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, because this is something that people are not used to, right? Yes. There's also like these self-limiting beliefs.
Yes.
That you go into it, there's like, would people take this seriously? Mm-hmm. You know, the whole like looking glass self, right? Like if people are looking at, you know, when I do this, how are people going to think about me? Yes. Right? How are people going to judge my knowledge base or yes. even my legitimacy? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there was that crisis. And so it took a bit of time to really learn and become more confident.
And were you learning while working?
Exactly, exactly. And I do believe that that's actually the best way to learn.
Yes.
Like you're not gonna like read theories. Like I have facilitation books, you know, the art of facilitation, you know, collective visioning. And
you've memorized them all, right?
I have read all of them, you know, Augusto Boal, I've read everything, right?
Yeah.
But it is not until mm-hmm. you actually use the body to do mm-hmm. it that it starts making sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there was a lot of learning. There was a lot of making mistakes. And it was frightening because every time that like a mistake was made, you know, as a team, like sometimes we're very harsh with each other, mm-hmm. right? Because we're all trying to be like good. Mm-hmm. Please people but also we're struggling,
yes,
so we hadn't
and
really,
learning yeah.
and learning yeah so we hadn't really, even though we believed in learning, we hadn't really figured out how do we actually put this philosophy of learning into how we work
our own people. Relationships
exactly into our own relationships.
Big question.
So it you know, it took time, and we're still learning. Like mm-hmm. we haven't gotten everything figured out. I haven't gotten everything figured out. I'm still learning. And I will continue to learn until I go to my grave. That mm-hmm. is the essence of being human, so to
yeah.
speak.
Yeah. And at the heart of this work, in a way, I mean, like you say, the work is in the body. So yeah. it doesn't have a place where you stop.
Totally.
Okay, so this is exciting. So now you've got this team dynamic. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of why these podcasts, this is really what I'm interested in, interviewing the whole Bloom team, mm-hmm. is to learn about what does it mean to collectivize or collaborate as facilitators? Up until this point with the podcast, I've been interviewing people who they may work on teams, but I'm interviewing them as individuals. Hello. But here I'm very, very interested. You're all very strong personalities on the Bloom team. I've just joined. I haven't worked with anyone yet, but it's very clear just from the meetings that there's a lot of really an incredible vitality in every single person, mm-hmm. and a lot of difference in style. I mean, this is just from the first few meetings. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in how you work a team dynamic when you have so many extremely powerful characters. I don't know if that's something you can talk to or not. Maybe people are just going to have to ascertain that by listening to all of the podcasts.
Yeah. I do think that there is clarity of roles. I think that is very helpful.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, who calls the meetings, who is leading what, mm-hmm. and who mm-hmm. is managing what project. And, you know, in as much as we are, I'm going to be blunt, and as much as we are grounded in an equity sort of philosophy, we are still a hierarchical organization, right? And that actually makes things a little easier because responsibility roles become very clear. So Rehana and I are the co-directors, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We play specific roles because of the way sort of Bloom evolved over time, with Rehana being the kind of like almost like the full-time person for Bloom,
mm-hmm.
right? She takes a lot of the lead on a few, like most of the different elements of Bloom.
So this saves you. You don't have to be making sort of consensus decisions on the team.
No.
Which saves a lot of time.
No.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. No, we make, like, depending on the project that we're working on, right? If there's a team that is working on it, then the consensus piece comes into play.
Within that team,
yeah. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just like the general direction of the bigger strategic direction of the organization, it's Rehana and I.
Brilliant. Okay. That separation is very interesting. Did you all learn over time how to debrief and learn together from mistakes?
Yeah.
Is that something that you've developed a method or a practice around?
So, definitely. Like, we learned it. We all work in different contexts, right? So Rehana goes work with this organization or with this team. She comes with ideas. I go learn with her other organization that comes with ideas. So we're kind of like bringing, you know, different pieces. It's like, is there a bird that like lives? Oh, you know what? Actually, no, it's not a bird. Let me think about it. It's mice. Yeah, you know, mice build nests, right? Like the mice that live in the ground. But mm-hmm. Sometimes they are like 10 or so of them living together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of like, I think that's also almost like a metaphor for Bloom. So like, you know, one person gets a twig here, another person gets like a strand of grass, another person gets like this, and then we come and we build this nest that takes care of us. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that we exist in that nest without conflict. I mean, whenever people share space, there's always rubbing, right?
Yes.
It's always, we're building, you know, we are becoming, and each and every one of us is bringing a little bit.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, you're bringing up something that I've been wanting to ask. I'm really curious about, especially considering where your practice started, your early influences, mm-hmm. is the question of conflict in group dynamics. Everybody has a very different approach, and I'm really curious about yours. How, if you're working from this place, it's more raw. How are you working with conflict when it comes up in your groups?
We talk about it.
Huh.
I think that's kind of like the simplest way to say it. Yeah.
I mean, that's hot. That can be hot. It can be hard to talk about conflict.
Yeah, we do talk about it. I think one thing that is helpful is that we're all friends.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're friends, because we have related in you know, in other parts of our lives in different ways, we have come to understand that our relationships matter. Mm-hmm. And so if those relationships matter, we have to be as authentic as possible with each other. And so if anything happens, we need to talk about it. We create space for it. We listen to each other and we move forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see this making a very deep team dynamic that probably resonates for your clients. What do you do when the conflict is in the with the client?
We also talk about it.
The client.
Yeah. And one thing that at least my approach is to say, if I sense that there is a little bit of misalignment, right, mm-hmm. I will address it. Now, with the hope that the other party is also going to bring their authentic self and we can actually like have a real dialogue. Now, that is not always guaranteed. Mm-mm. So I've been in situations where, you know, there's been misunderstanding with clients. I bring up stuff and things worked out perfectly. And then there are some situations where I bring something up, I finish my contract, and the client says goodbye. And right. I know, okay, I actually understand. This is the way that the client avoids working with conflict or actually benefiting from conflict. I think conflict is, in as much as it can be full of tension, I think that tension itself is actually a source of wisdom.
Right? Oh, so, say more. Yeah. This is good.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you're familiar with Malidoma Some.
Mm-hmm, I am.
Right? And he has a line that I love, and I'm going to not accurately say it, but something to the effect that conflict tells us where our relationships need to deepen.
Mm, yeah.
Right. So mm-hmm. conflict actually shows where we are not aligned, where there has been a distance in our connection. And so when it emerges, it's telling us you need to come together. You need to come closer to each other. So in a way, like people talk about conflict as this thing that should like divide people and then creates boundaries and all these things.
Yes.
But what if we understand it as like, it's actually wisdom to say, just like think of like, you know, when your body feels off, right? Or like when your emotional self feels off, what is it telling you? It tells you something is not going well. Something needs to be attended to. And so conflict is actually an invitation to care for a relationship.
Wow. And then how do you support the group to take this as an understanding or to want to cross those lines? Because if we take that as the premise, the conflict is an invitation to care. There's all of this baggage often in the way or emotion or historical ways of being that can be habits, let's say, mm-hmm. that can be in the way. How do you support your groups to cross those lines?
It's honest, authentic dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Like really, we tend to use circle process.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Just hear every voice.
To hear every voice, to listen to each other. We also support individuals in really, because part of it is we are marinated in a culture that does not encourage dealing with conflict.
Right.
In fact, we exist in a culture that says one, conflict is bad, is dangerous. So the best way to deal with it is to avoid it, right? And my thinking is like, well, if it's already happened, you have not been able to avoid it. So it's there. So you might as well face it, right? Or two, that when conflict arises, people reach to other levers of power, then control,
oh, wow.
right? Yes. To like respond from that power over
yeah.
place, right? Mm-hmm. So conflict gets resolved, or it doesn't get resolved.
It gets squashed.
Gets worsened, but someone gets squashed and then they don't get listened to, etc. Right?
It's very profound what you're saying. You're talking about how this resource of conflict can get wasted. is what mm-hmm. I hear you talking about, mm-hmm. is that there are these ways that we're taught to either avoid it or mm-hmm. kill it, when mm-hmm. itself, it seems like this living thing that is calling.
Yeah.
It has a voice and it's calling for something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm so moved by that, because it's so easy to imagine like things like school systems and policing systems mm-hmm. and all these kinds of systems that are actually built to train people to avoid or squash conflict.
Yeah.
Where is the venue for this listening?
Exactly. So there is like in most organizations, a punitive approach is always used when conflict mm-hmm. arises. Mm-hmm. So we support people at a personal level to reflect deeply on their relationship with conflict, right? And this could be conflict within ourselves, right? We are a system, as I said earlier on, and how, you know, when there are things that do not align within ourselves, how do we approach that? We punish ourselves.
Yeah. Right?
And then if what we have practiced is punishing ourselves, then what happens when others out exactly? That's we right. also reach for that tool that we are familiar with. You know, it's Chris Corrigan, mm. One of my mentors mm. from Art the Art of Hosting community, mm-hmm. who says that you get very good at what you practice. That's and right. that is very true. And in this case of conflict. Yeah, so we support people in really reflecting on how they relate to conflict, in resolving for themselves how they show up for themselves. Right.
Wow, that is so profound. Yeah. I can just imagine your clients being like, what did I sign up for here?
Yeah.
I'm going through a process of actually self-investigation in order mm-hmm. to work mm-hmm. with my colleagues mm-hmm. in a business environment, in a work environment.
Exactly. And so like we do coaching with leaders, and one of the key things that we focus on, or we meditate on together, is really around tension, discomfort, conflict. How do you, if leaders can really relate to this in a way that encourages relationship deepening, I think we're getting somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited to see you at work. This is really, it's very profound. I love it. I mean, I when I think about my own practices of mediation and conflict work, it resonates here, but there's a kind of an aspect of love that you're talking about that I think is explicit. I imagine that you're making it somehow explicit. And it's very exciting. It's very rare.
Thank you.
Yeah. I wonder if you have any ideas for people. Like I know that there's a lot of people listening to these podcasts that are new mm-hmm. in this journey, you know, and they have a vision for community, and they have a vision for their own role as a leader. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you have anything that you might share with them if they're noticing they're reaching these obstacles.
Yeah.
You know, they're finding conflict intractable in their groups.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, first and foremost is that conflict is a part of humanity. Like this is just, it's like the way we need to breathe to survive, we also need conflict.
Whoa, to grow. Wow.
Oh, totally. Totally.
Like as a negotiation or something?
Well, like I think that if we take a very liberal definition of conflict, right, which is like misalignment, really, mm-hmm. okay. then it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. We experience it within ourselves. We experience it with objects. We experience it with humans. We experience it with animals. You know what I'm saying?
True.
We experience it at the larger political level.
It's something like now you're talking about like friction or something.
Exactly.
Like,
it's free. Yeah. Exactly. That energy is actually essential.
I love that. Then it becomes essential, like you're saying. Yeah, that's the generating energy.
Yeah, wow. And I'm not saying that we should go around and like provoking people so that we can create
That's
landing opportunities.
That's not the advice that you're giving.
So that we can create landing opportunities for ourselves. No. I'm saying when it arises, embrace it. Right? Embrace it, notice it, name it as such. Right? And really go deeper within yourself first. Because I think one of the things that tend to happen with us is, and I'm not sure it's if it's our nature, I'm not sure if it's our socialization, but this inclination to externalize.
Yes.
Right? And then when we externalize, especially in a rush, we tend to react in a possibly like mostly in a defensive way or in a way that points, you know, outside, right? And in a way that apportions blame.
Yeah.
Right. So my invitation is really go back to you. Right. And I love working with compassionate communication here, nonviolent communication here around that.
Right? Internally with yourself.
Internally, right? What are you observing? Mm-hmm. What are you noticing?
What do you need?
Factually, what are you noticing? What actually happened? No interpretation. What actually happened? Like, okay, somebody said these words to me. That's it, right? Observe what happened. And then, you know, ask, how are you feeling, right? I'm feeling hurt. You own the feelings. You know, feelings are not imposed on people by other people, right? Feelings come from within us. What do you need, right? And then, what requests can you make? Right? And needs here, like, you know, in NVC, it's like needs are not attached to a particular person. This is just like what you need generally. Like, I need to feel safe, no matter who I'm connected to, no matter whatever situation the situation is, I just need to feel safe, right? And if, you know, an incident happens that sort of, what is called destabilizes that, then that is how you formulate your request, right?
And in this case, to yourself.
So you do it to yourself. Like, what do I need? I need safety. I need this. And then, you know, you then think about then how do I express this to the other person, right? And so you are being very compassionate to yourself, and hopefully that compassion to the self translates to compassion to the other.
Now, that in the to do that in the moment is a takes a level of self incredible self awareness, because you can't always be prepared when you come into a group.
No, it's practice. So one thing that I will add to people who are coming in is to say, learn through practice. Mm-hmm. Like, I understand, like, you know, there's need to read, there's need to go to workshops. I think that is all important. However, I believe that in actually doing it, that's where really the truth is. Like, I, you know, people talk about knowledge, right? Knowledge. And I like to say, there's no knowledge, there's knowledge practices, right? You know, when we have information, it does not make us knowledgeable. We have information. Mm-hmm. But when we can actually translate that information into how we do things, into how we relate, then that actually becomes real, right? So let's learn through that. Let's make the mistakes. Someone wise said to me, if you're not making mistakes, you're not learning. Let's make those mistakes, and knowing that, like, we are not going to make mistakes that are catastrophic. Like we are going to make mistakes that provide us with an opportunity to learn and grow.
And I guess part of that then is, and this is a tough one for facilitators, is that there has to be an ability to let go. So
indeed.
That is that, and to not see that as catastrophic.
Exactly. Indeed. So yeah, like, we are attached to perfection, I think that is the word, right? We're in this society,
fixing,
right? You have been hired, you're supposed to be an expert. Hell no, I'm not an expert. And I don't want to be. I actually don't want to be.
Yeah.
Because the moment that I think that I have mastered it, I've actually lost the opportunity to invest in my need for continuing learning and becoming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah. I think, yeah, just to say that, like, we are not going to be perfect because we do not live in a static reality, right? Culture is shifting. We are changing all the time. Other people are changing all the time. You know, with the diversity of humans on the earth, like, we are always, there's always something that is shifting. And so we, you know, it's good to just like have this openness that we're always students, we're always learners, and we're always ready to receive, right? And that learning orientation is actually helpful because even in the context of, like, for example, you make, you know, a mistake in facilitation,
mm-hmm.
you're more likely to be open to feedback, right?
Yes.
Then feedback comes not as judgment, but as an invitation to continue to grow.
Yes, that information that you need. Yeah,
exactly.
In this moment.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes, very. It really paints a very. It's a visionary picture that you're painting right now of another way. Like, I almost imagine an old husk kind of falling off, you know, where conflict and intensities and this kind of rawness and authenticity actually become guiding forces in organizations.
Totally. Totally.
And then they don't need the externals in the same way because they have this space making.
Exactly.
So you basically trying not to work. The consultancy.
Well, that's what we say, right? We want to work ourselves outside of out of jobs. No, it's literally, like, I would be happy, right? I would be happy to see organizations thriving without my support.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's what I'm looking for. Because at the end of the day, you know, I am not, yes, I earn a living from this, but that is not the end goal. Like, mm-hmm. I approach it from I still have my mother's activist ethos, right? What mm-hmm. What is the goal here? You know, the goal here is not to defeat a battalion of colonial army. The goal here is to create a world where everybody belongs.
Yeah. Right?
And if that work can be shared, then we get there sooner.
We get there sooner. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So, wow. It's a beautiful place to end, actually. But I do have maybe a couple of other questions just in case. So we could end it there. But I guess I'm curious about your own sort of fascination in the right now. Like, is there something right now that there's so many aspects of this work. Is there anything that you're really kind of working on personally right now?
What do you mean when you say working on? Right,
like, is there something you're trying to, like, when you first, you know, moved from being a speaker to learning about facilitation, you had this particular problem you were asking yourself, like, mm-hmm. How do I bring the arts to a group in such a way as they don't think I'm not intelligent? Right. So is there something you're working with right now, studying in particular?
Oh, there's always a lot.
Okay.
It's always a lot. How do I respond to this? I'm just thinking, are you thinking in terms of methodology? Are you thinking in terms of just
I'm
like
thinking like about the
issues,
the development of craft, really?
Oh, the development of craft. Yeah. I think we are still at the beginnings of folks feeling comfortable with art-based methods with embodied approaches. And so what I am really meditating on is, how do we normalize this in the institutions that we're a part of? Right? How do I, you know, get a CEO to do it in their meetings, in their own facilitation work? Right. What is the approach that will really shift people into embracing that we have this holistic, we have this whole body to rely on. We also have, you know, songs, we have stories, we have games, we have humor, we have all these tools that we can actually use.
So, people have a fear or they have a resistance.
Well, we're still kind of culturally in the West. We're still stuck in what's the French philosopher, Descartes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think therefore I am.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that I see what I just said. I think that. So we are still there. We're still there that if we are not using our minds, then we are not being intellectual, right? Mm-hmm. Then we are not really saying anything profound. We're not doing anything profound, or we are not learning. Because learning is very much connected to a change in the mind, right?
Yeah.
So we're kind of still stuck there culturally.
Yeah. And I hear you saying there's a difference between as a facilitator, how do I get a group to do this? And then how does the culture of that organization undertake
shift.
That?
Exactly. So we are, with Bloom, we are really interested in culture shift, right? We want individuals to change, definitely, because, you kind of have to change individuals to change culture, right? And we want culture to change, and we want systems to change. Mm-hmm. So leaders play a huge role in this, right? Because in hierarchical environments, leaders tend to hold the power, to make decisions on the different things that other people can do, right? So even the philosophy of organizations is actually a reflection of the leadership.
Yeah.
Right. So my
thing, even at an unconscious level, I imagine.
Oh yes. So my meditations these days is how do I? What are the ways that we can really have these conversations? Because I know that the moment that everybody in the organization starts accessing, ways of doing and knowing from different aspects of themselves, the body, their emotional selves, their brains, we have a richer community.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. More bonds, deeper bonds, more possibility for bonding.
Exactly. Yeah. There's this deeper consciousness that happens. So that's what I've been thinking about. I'm really these days, I'm really focused on leadership and facilitation of change at a, leadership level.
Oh, that's a whole other podcast. I cannot, I'm rarely looking forward to diving in that. But I wonder if we can get just a little deeper with it now. I know that's I can good. See that we could talk about it for an hour.
Yeah.
But I wonder, when you're working with leadership, are there specific challenges that you are facing that are different, that you bring a different skill set when you're working with an organizational leader?
Yeah. So a lot of leaders are hired on the basis that they think. We're still like, I feel like
yeah.
we are there where I think therefore I am like people's identities are so, what is the word? They are so much reliant on thinking, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of leaders are one hired because they are understood to be thinkers, right? Yeah. And so the challenge is for me when I'm talking, when I'm having conversations with leaders is how do you shift from that mindset? How do you move from being a thinking person to a whole person?
Wow. Right. That's very vulnerable.
So, yeah. And that is the challenge. Like it's huge. Like I know, like when I do like coaching sessions with leaders, I begin with meditation. Let's get into the body.
Oh, really? Okay.
Like you see people going like,
People are stiff, right? Yeah, stiff and
because
afraid.
As if you're asking somebody to, if you're asking them to take off their clothes, right? Mm-hmm. The moment that you say the body, right? Like it feels like, oh yeah, right? Because it is in a culture that send us logos.
Yes.
The body is just like the what can I say? Like props up, right? Props up the head. Like its function is not, you know, as a knowledge source, but to hold the head. So the challenge is getting that openness from leaders. But there's also the challenge that comes from within, right? Those limiting beliefs. Mm-hmm. You say, is this the right time to do this? Right? I start asking myself questions, or even in our conversations as a team. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we don't think this team is this leadership team is there yet to do these things, right? Mm-hmm. Because we are scared. We're also scared.
And
right?
How do you bring your body against their mind?
Right.
You're already at this, you're on the back foot in this incredible way, but you don't want to come head to head. You want to bring your body's wisdom forward, and it's vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, there's like, you know, the difficulty at the personal level in really thinking about the appropriateness of it, or the relevance of it, or the, whether that is going to be accepted. But, you know, more and more, I've gotten to a point where I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do it. Hmm. This is how I do it. This is my way. And if it resonates, great. If it doesn't, I'll keep on doing it.
Mm-hmm. That conviction, that depth.
Yeah.
It makes me want to ask you one other question comes to my mind. Maybe this will be the last one. And maybe, I don't know if you
we
want
can have
to
another conversation.
I think there is another conversation, to be honest. And I've said that actually almost with all of these podcasts. Some people are so interesting. Because also the theory around this work hasn't been, I think, fully. I think that there's a lot of wisdom in the practice that people bring that I don't read in the books. It's in the stories, really.
It's in the stories. Agreed.
And one thing I'm, you're an extraordinary musician, and I wonder about how you see that in your work, because that's a place of expertise. So, do you feel that your music is it in your work in ways that you can really? Could you talk about how you see the music in your work?
It's interesting. It's a very interesting question. I think one thing that my music comes into my work is actually how I learned music.
Okay.
More, right? Okay. That the first time that I touched mbira to play it, it was so hard that I was like, nah, this is it. I'm not playing this instrument.
Really?
And then I picked it up and learned one song. I just like kept on repeating that song for a very long time. And then I learned the other, and then another, and they started composing. Right? So just like this belief that I can learn.
Mm.
And that belief translates to transformation, change is actually possible.
Wow.
Right? Like if you think about, you know, facilitation of change as engaging in art making, you can create it. You can yes. build it. You can yes. construct it.
You can practice it.
You can practice it.
Wow. That's a beautiful answer.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Hmm. Yeah. And of course, there's also like really the wisdom that comes from the songs themselves, right? I see that coming in, the stories that comes from the songs themselves, the architecture of the song. So like the idea of call and response, that is part of, you know, Zimbabwean music, African music in general. And that like that, there's you, to the extent that we say like, you can't play mbira alone, for example, you always mm-hmm. have to have somebody. Like everything has to be collaborated. You don't perform mbira, like you don't have an audience. Everybody you is a creator. Exactly. Wow. Yeah. So that philosophy informs the way I do facilitation work. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a relationship.
Yeah.
Right? It's a relation. Like if when you listen to mbira music, you have parts that interlock. And the way these parts interlock is in such a way that you don't see which part is which.
Oh, wow.
Right? Yeah, like, yes, I can play you. I can play you. I can say, okay, this is Nemamsasa and this is how you play the call, which is Kushaura, so you go. That's how you play the call. So you can hear it if I'm playing it separately. And then I'm like, okay, but this is how you play Gutsinira. But when they are played together, they're like this.
Wow.
They become like a compound.
Huh. A new thing.
A new thing. And that's what is possible when people collaborate.
That's what's in the relationship.
That's what's in the relationship.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Incredible. I'm just so inspired by this discussion. I think people are going to love this.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for creating this space.
Very
it's really
exciting.
Beautiful to reflect.
Yeah, it's been really fascinating just to have the space to hear your story. But I have a strong feeling we could do this for a lot longer. And I would like to do it again, actually.
I'm down.
Great.
I'm down.
Great. I think there's a lot here that you've touched that I think even as an interviewer, I need to absorb it before the next questions can even emerge. It's very exciting.
Yeah.